Tonight on Arena, Gladiator 2, Joy and Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat are the movies up for review, and Colm McInamara on his part in Colm McCann's Narrative 4 project. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. Film reviews to start this evening: Ancient Rome via Maynooth, IVF's origin story, and a documentary about jazz and geopolitics. If you've been living under a stone, Gladiator 2 has finally landed. It's a kind of a big deal, I think it's safe to say, in this part of the world, not least because of Kildare's finest, Paul Mescal. He is the star of the film. Director Ridley Scott brings us back to ancient Rome in a story that pits gladiatorial prowess against the vagaries of tyrannical power, this time round in the shape of capricious twin emperors. Joy is the latest release from Netflix. It stars Bill Nye, James Norton and Thomasin McKenzie. They are the talented trio who pioneered in vitro fertilisation. And in the much lauded documentary Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat, we learn about the intersection of jazz music, politics and state-sanctioned assassinations of a world leader. John McGuire and Arlene Hunt, been to the movies, they're with me in studio now. We'll start with Gladiator 2. Where else would you be starting? It surely tests the internet's much-discussed theory on how often men think about the Roman Empire on a daily basis. John McGuire, clearly.
Not that often.
Yeah, not too often myself either. So that's we can't ask you that question, Arlene Hunt. Our own Paul Mescal plays Lucius, who you may remember as a child in the first film. Lucius, that is, not Paul Mescal. But certainly young Lucius has now grown up, and Ridley Scott has assembled an impressive supporting cast, including Denzel Washington and Pedro Pascal. But will the film live up to the reputation of its illustrious ancestor? As I think about the number of times I've thought about the Roman Empire today, only when I've been thinking about this film. Arlene, seeing as you haven't been thinking about it at all during the day, where are we in ancient Roman history? Or is ancient Roman history even important here? I suppose, where are we in Gladiator, Ridley Scott Gladiator history?
I think we're 10 years behind the original. Mm. And Rome has now been ruled by two emperors, twins, although they're different in size and in every other shape and way. And they are, as you say, they're capricious. They're also slightly barking mad. And their idea of fun is to torture and have as much bloodshed as is humanly possible. So therefore, the Colosseum is a major part of, you know, what keeps them alive, because I don't think their own people are overly fond of them.
And just on a purely technical issue, a historical point of interest, if you get one thumbs up from one emperor and a thumbs down from the other emperor, is it tough luck?
I just think you just hook your thumbs together like that and hope for the best. It's one of the brothers is the leader and the other is the follower.
It's the leader some.
He carries the weight. Right. But there's a curious dynamic between the two brothers as well, which it fleshes out throughout the film as well.
Okay, John, Gladiator. The original, it's a tough act to follow.
I mean, these are big sandals to fill, yeah.
You've been thinking about that one all day.
It wasn't at all.
But it is a tough act to follow. When the first Gladiator
came out in the year 2000, swords and sandals epics were deeply unfashionable, as was Ridley Scott, actually, who had endured a decade of duds. And you had this vastly scaled, impeccably realised vision of ancient Rome, a semi-historical story of power and intrigue and vengeance. It swept the box office, swept the Oscars, catapulted Russell Crowe to absolute stardom. This grizzled, growling hero Maximus became a defining character, an icon really of that millennial era, and returned Ridley Scott to the pinnacle of A-list directors. And here we are, a quarter of a century later. Epics of the ancient world are again outdated after two decades of Marvel. Why would you want to go back to dust and togas? And Ridley Scott has had another run of misfires and duds, the Alien movie, Napoleon in particular. And given how things have worked out for Crowe's Maximus, a sequel here was not always inevitable. Mm. And most epics would have an inevitable sequel, but it wasn't the case here. And Gladiator 2, unfortunately, to me anyway, feels like it could have needed another 25 years. It needed a lot of work before this. You see, Mescal who is an actor, who can act. There's absolutely no doubt about that. After Sun was no fluke. Yeah, I really admired him.
And he's done more than that too. He's
and Normal People.
Yeah.
The list goes on. He is ready for this ascent to the kind of Russell Crowe stardom, this to repeat the trick. But this is a film that is very shabbily put together. And script-wise, it starts with the script. Never mind the cast, never mind the actors. They have to do what they have to do. But in terms of a story, it's actually the same story. It's a simple retread of the original film with the addition of an extra emperor. And we have, as Oliver Reed said in the first film, it's the slave who became a gladiator. The gladiator became an icon, a hero, whatever it was. The hero who defined an emperor. It's the same story.
And in this case, Paul Mescal, it's his wife that has been...
His wife, who's a warrior, by the way. Yes. She wasn't just sitting at home with her son waiting for him to come back or anything like that.
We
she
see
was killed
in
battle.
In a Sylvian glade at the start, before the Romans attack. Yeah. And the Romans are led by... a character who becomes instrumental to the whole story, who's played by Pedro Pascal, Marcus Gratius, who's the general. He brings them all back to Rome as slaves. Denzel Washington's character, Messias, sees something in Mescal. Yeah.
Macronos, isn't he?
Macronos. Sees something in this warrior and brings him to the Colosseum.
She's rage in him.
Rage and promises him this, this opportunity.
Yeah, that
to
all sounds
his
very
vengeance.
Familiar from Gladiator, doesn't it?
It does. All roads, unfortunately, lean back to the same place.
Well, let's have a listen to Paul Mescal as Lucius and the aforementioned Denzel Washington as Macronos discussing the state of Rome.
The greatest temple Rome ever built, the Colosseum, because this is what they believe in: power. They gather here to watch the strong strike down the weak.
There has to be something else.
There is nothing else.
There has to be another Rome.
There is no other Rome. The dream? Mm. The dream of Rome? It's an old man's fantasy.
Who are you? Mm. What was your name before you traded it for a Roman one?
You'll never know. I have a destiny. The gods delivered you to me. You will be my instrument.
I will never be your instrument in this life or the next.
Definitely, I was just saying there's a touch of the Russell Crowe in everything that Paul Mescal is doing there. That's Paul Mescal as Lucius, Denzel Washington as Macronos.
Apart from the occasional lines which made me laugh out loud, which is when they're going out for their very first battle in the Colosseum, he said, "This is a battle of survival, so survive."
That's a good
line. A rousing speech to the men.
How does Paul Mescal handle it? Because, I mean, I don't think is there a person in the country that doesn't want him to succeed here?
Yeah, you'd like to see him do well because, you know, he's a good actor. I just, and God forbid me, you know, I'm not trying to put away my tricolour or anything else, but I do feel he's slightly miscast. Genuinely, he's playing on a different level to everybody else. It feels like he's playing on a different level to everybody else. Denzel Washington is chewing up scenery and having a whale of a time in this. You know, the emperors are camp cartoony villains. Everyone's dialed it up to 111.
So he's going for some kind of emotional truth.
Yeah.
But Crowe managed that and the
You have to remember something
stuff.
About Russell Crowe and the performance that Russell Crowe gave. You know, as Gladiator opens up, he's a general. He's a war wearied general, and his men respect him because he walks the walk. He is who he says he is. He's a general. He has led men. He has led legions. His own emperor thinks he's the greatest thing since sliced bread. You know, Marcus Aurelius thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread. This was a man who carried gravitas and who carried violence within him. But Paul Mescal's carrying with Lucius, you know, there's an awful, like at one point Macronos keeps saying to him, you know, "It's your rage I'm after, it's your rage." And then everyone else starts talking about his rage until eventually you just feel like you're being walloped over the head with a rubber ducky about this rage. And it's like, fine, but on the moments when he's not filled with rage, he has dialed it all the way back. So he's kind of, you know, he's acting very
internalized.
Pulled in, and he's internalized a lot of his feelings and he's internalized a lot of his anger. So there are two different Lucius on screen.
Yeah. I think Arlene hit the nail on the head when she said the word camp, because there is that unmistakable feeling of that kind of epic Roman opera that Scott is trying to. But in opera, you have to move and sing at the same time. And that's where Mescal has the problem. Yes, in the intimate scenes, he's really, really magnetic.
With the close-ups, he's great. Yeah. Amazing.
He has the muscles. He can swing a sword. Physically, he looks the part. When he has to do the two things at the same time, as an epic like this insists you do, there are dialogue scenes in the middle of fights.
Yeah,
great things happen, characters collide. That's where he struggles, right. And it unfortunately undermines everything else that's going on.
You've both mentioned Pedro Pascal, and you've both mentioned the campness of Geta, played by Joseph Quinn and Fred Hechinger's
Caccarella.
Well, here are the two emperors and Pedro Pascal in action together.
There will be games in the Colosseum.
I require no games in my honour. Serving the Senate and the people of Rome is honour enough for me.
You are too modest, Acacius. It does not suit a general as accomplished as yourself.
The glory is yours, not mine. I only ask for some respite from war, to spend time with my wife.
Your wife, yes. Remember the privileges we have granted her? Where is she now to ignore such an occasion?
There are victories yet still to come. Persia. India. Both must be conquered.
Rome has so many subjects. She must feed them.
They can eat war!
That's Joseph Quinn and Fred Hechinger as the twin emperors, and Pedro Pascal, as the returning hero, General Acacius, who sounds as if he has all of those general qualities that Russell Crowe's character had in the first film, but quite stilted, I thought, in the delivery that I heard there.
Yeah, and I thought he was surprisingly toothless as a general, and I genuinely mean that. I thought he was slightly. I'm not sure what he was going for here, because, you know, at one point he laments to his wife that, you know, it's the crying of the women on the battlefield that really got to him. And I thought, you're a Roman general. You have gone out to conquer this for your empire. There's no way. In fact, you wouldn't hear those women, because they'd all be your concubines and slaves on the way back to the ship. You wouldn't hear them crying because you wouldn't have time for it. Yeah. So there's this weird kind of, he's trying to play it off in a, almost like he's a modern man and things weigh heavily on his soul.
Yeah.
But, you know, for a battle-wearied general...
Yeah, you can't be,
And
Barry Keoghan was due, I think, to play one of those emperors.
He's the character...
Did he make the right call, do you think, here,
I don't know if the call was his to make, but he was the Caccarella character, Fred, that played by Fred Hechinger with his monkey. And he's quite an interesting character. I think the dissolution of the how rotten they became is a really interesting area of exploration.
Right.
The issues are is that they're trying to... There were straight lines in Gladiator all the way through, straight emotional lines, straight dramatic lines. Everything here is tangled and confused. There are other issues of lineage. There's issues of how these characters are connected that we haven't even hinted at that confuse the thing. Right. And it's just eventually starts to get wearisome.
And it's a long watch. However, it sounds as if there's a touch of the curate's egg about this. Good in spots, bad in spots.
This is it. Are we not entertained? Yes, kind of. It's far from a disaster. The action stuff is great.
Yeah.
It was an amazing fight with a troop, or is it a murder or whatever, of baboons that Mescal is superb in. And, you know, digitally, the visual effects work.
But that's a violent fight, and that's what makes it work. It's the fact that they're in the dirt, they're in the dust fighting, hand on hand.
He can do all of that kind of stuff all day long.
There's a fight scene in this that, like, takes you out of the Colosseum because it's so ludicrous. And all I'm saying is sharks. That's all I'm saying.
I think that there's a central confrontation right at the centre of the film that's drawn out and wildly uneven and seems to be missing a couple of lines of crucial dialogue. And it's so immediately obvious that you suspect that, like he has done before, Ridley Scott will go back and rework this film. And there'll be a four-hour cut.
A director's cut.
There'll be a four-hour cut that will make sense, at least.
Yeah, they should be called a director's non-cut.
Yeah, maybe.
Nothing gets lost. All right. What are you saying in terms of stars?
Three for me, it's very uneven. There are good bits in it, but it's very uneven and it lacks the emotional right. punch of the first film.
And what are you saying, Arlene?
I just said the same thing. I just said it was mildly fluffy guff, but without the emotional punch of the first film.
Mildly fluffy guff.
Mildly fluffy guff.
Okay. Which is.
But it was 3 out of 5. It was. Yeah. I mean, it's fun in places. Yeah,
so it's not a disaster. All right. It's all right. Okay. Let's move on then to Joy, latest release from Netflix. Goes into selected cinemas this weekend and then is on Netflix from tomorrow week, in fact. The film is about the three people at the centre of developing IVF, in vitro fertilisation, a scientific breakthrough that has, in the 4 decades since, of course, helped so many people to conceive. The story at the heart of this, the three people at the heart of it, who are they, John, first of all, and what's the kind of dynamic between the three of them?
They're three remarkable individuals, really. We're in the late 1960s. Real life individuals. Yeah, there's the obstetrician, Patrick Steptoe, who's played by Bill Nighy. There's a pioneering physician working in Cambridge out of his own laboratory, Robert Edwards. He's played by James Norton.
Yeah.
And there's a nurse turned embryologist, Jean Purdy, who's really the hero of this film. Mm. And she's played by Thomasin McKenzie. So we watch as these three people connect, first of all, because they're not connected as the story opens. And they doggedly and quietly and courageously, as it turns out, work together to make this breakthrough in IVF and in vitro fertilization. It will change lives and create lives and around the world.
Yeah. Let's listen to a clip which involved, it's the moment when, at this stage, the Jean Purdy, who's the nurse played by Thomasin McKenzie, and Bob Edwards, the obstetrician. He's the obstetrician.
No, he's the biologist.
Sorry, beg your pardon. Played by James Norton. He's the fella in the lab. He's doing all the work in the lab. They're together. They've worked out that they can work together, but they need somebody. They need an obstetrician.
They need someone with technical know-how how to handle a body.
And who can also manage the medical council. That's the real focus
and
that's
so they have to persuade Bill Nighy to come on board with them. And here is the scene where they're trying to do that.
You teach at Cambridge, Dr. Edwards, is that right?
I do.
All my clinical material is in Oldham. Cambridge is 200 miles away.
Well, in the short term, we'll set up at yours. It's only a 4-hour drive. And in the long term, we'll get money from the Medical Research Council and move you south. That is, if you're willing to be moved south.
I could be persuaded.
We'll need women. Women willing to contribute ovarian tissue.
I have some hysterectomy patients who, if I explain what we're doing, might be prepared to help us.
Oh, he's not just got the skills, he's also got the contacts.
You're aware they'll throw the book at this. The church, the state, the world. We will unite them all against us.
But we'll have the mothers. The mothers will back us.
Right. If I don't go now, I'll miss the 5:25 and I'll never be home. Bob. Jean.
You're in, aren't you?
We'll speak soon, I hope.
There we have the three of them. Bill Nighy as Dr. Steptoe, James Norton as Bob Edwards, and Thomasin McKenzie as Jean Purdy, the young nurse who kind of is the glue that keeps the whole thing together. But Bill Nighy at the end of that, or in the middle of that clip, Arlene, hits on what the film really gets at, which is the whole world.
Oh.
The whole world.
Yeah.
The tabloids, the
particularly
church,
the tabloids, particularly the Mirror that went after them.
They went at them. Yeah.
They call them, Dr. Frankenstein, and they whipped up public, a backlash against them. Everything they did, if they went onto a television show and tried to explain. It's interesting because Bob Edwards is he's a brilliant mind, but he's enormously inarticulate.
Scatterbrained,
so he's a tendency to put his foot in it and leave things open and fall into the trap. It gets baited so easily. I think it's a fictitious piece actually, but there's a where he goes on to the television show and he's debating against Dr. James Watson, who had just won a Nobel Prize for DNA, and he in the middle of this kind of fairly mild argument, he turns to him and he goes, "Oh, so I'm a Nazi doctor now." And of course, the next day the headlines are like Nazi doctor, and it's all Mengelism, It's.
Well, I think Edwards also makes the point that if this is the James Norton character says, if this was a male issue, exclusively a male issue, then there would be none of these conversations would be happening.
But they found that even when they went to the medical council though to look for funding, which was super important for them to keep going with their research, they brought that up in the medical council as well. It's like, because somebody was very dismissive and saying, well, it only affects a few. And it was Purdy who said, you know, it affects more than a few, and it affects a lot of women and a lot of families, not just women, but families, men who are married to these women and want to start a family and want to have a family.
The religious question as well, they address that as well. Again, slightly askew. A lot of their, they come at these issues from the side, really. They don't confront them directly. They're more focused on the dynamics.
And I was worried about when I was watching, I thought, there's a lot of science coming at us here, and how do you make that dramatic? You know, they're going to...
There's a lot of test tubes. Yeah. We see a lot of pipettes.
Yeah. But one of the things that did add to the drama, and I kind of wanted a bit more of it. We do meet Louise Brown, who was the first baby born by this method.
Yeah.
And we do meet their parents at some point along the way. But we do meet some of the women too, one played by Joanna Scanlon, the other played by Charlie Murphy. We meet several of these women.
Yeah, the original group, that they would have come together in the hope that they would have been able to transplant these embryos back into them. They were the ovum group.
Yeah.
And... you know, these were younger women and they would have been the first test group, which was unfortunate. There was an ectopic pregnancy and some failed. And you know, there's a point in the car where, Purdy has an argument with Edwards about how, you know, you don't even know these women. They're just numbers on a test tube to you. And then he calls out the name of every single one of the women. Yeah. And he said, I have to have them as a number, because if I fail in science, I'll bring everyone down.
And the other thing is, there's a beautiful moment when they're talking about those women. And you hear from several of the women saying, I know that it's a problem for, that it hasn't worked for me, but this will work for somebody.
It will.
And the kind of the altruism
camaraderie
of
it as well. They were, you know, the women got to know each other. There was a camaraderie between, a solidarity between them as well, because they were all suffering and going through the same situation.
Yeah, it's kind of a feel good movie, but in some ways there were aspects that I thought, well, let's really look at what the tabloids or the media is doing here. Let's really look at what the church is doing here. But it does concentrate on the three of them, and that's the story.
It's joy by name, joy by nature. This is an uplifting, a crowd pleasing film, and about what is a potentially devastating experience for this, specifically in the late 60s and early 1970s. But it's all a bit stagey and a bit cozy in a way as well, and gentle, and it has difficulty at times navigating these shifting emotional tones.
Although I defy anybody, when you get the update, and please don't say anything about the update as to where the three characters are now. There are certain parts of that.
Oh no, it's
just
very
break
touching.
Your heart.
It is very touching. Yeah, it is very touching.
Did it work overall? And stars from you, John?
A 3 for me. I enjoyed watching. I did not expect to like this film as much as I did, and I even the first 5 minutes or so, I was like, this is not going to work. But it wins you around.
Three fine performances.
The value of the story, first of all. Yes. This is a story that is absolutely worth telling. Yes, they are a little clumsy at times in how they tell it. But these are three really good actors. And Bill Nighy has never delivered a line like in your clip. If I don't leave now, I'll be late for the 5:25. I mean, that's a perfect Bill Nighy line. Yeah. So if you like Bill Nighy, and I would watch him paint his spare room. I think he's a super actor.
He's really good
in this.
Yeah. Okay, so 3. And what are you saying, Arlene?
I'm giving it 4 out of 5, because when the extract 67481 became Baby Louise Joy Brown, there's a little moment in it where they brought together for a photograph and the child is like tucked up in their arms. And it actually, I'm giving it one more point just for that. It was so emotional. Yeah. It just got me right in the heart.
It is very touching in places, that is for sure. Okay, 3 and 4 respectively then for Joy. As I said, Netflix next week, but in cinemas, selected cinemas this week. And finally then, A Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat, latest documentary feature from Belgian director Johan Grimompré. Story is ostensibly about global civil rights movement in the 1960s and the fall. If colonialism has fallen, the fight against colonialism in the 1950s. It's a big canvas that they have here, John, and they're telling us an awful lot. No talking heads, just with archive material.
Archive material and jazz music. And the two together are just sensational. This is an extraordinary film. I had no expectation. I did not know, other than the brilliant title, Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat, I had no idea what I was watching when I turned it on. And I was gripped right from the opening moments. This is an extraordinary multimedia experience. You could, and I did, you could just turn on this movie and just listen to it. You don't even have to watch the footage that they have. The soundtrack is extraordinary. The way that Grimompré has combined audio, music, and visuals here is extraordinarily impressive. And it's combines that free jazz of the early 60s with the global civil rights movement and the African push for decolonization centered on the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the first democratically elected prime minister of the Congo. But it's also about the multinational corporations working with the CIA and other arms of the US military-industrial complex to corrupt and control African independence for mining rights for the vast mineral wealth like the Congo contain, the countries like the Congo contain and still contain.
And certainly you learn a lot about African history there. I learned a lot about African history in this.
Oh, me too.
I didn't get to watch all of it.
Eye-opening.
What I saw, I thought, I need to sit and really spend time with this. Let's have a listen to a clip that gives us a sense of how the archive material, I think it's Dizzy Gillespie is the voice we're going to hear there. How the archive voices of those people and the music of those people is mixed in with the kind of the geopolitics of the time.
How do you remember 1960? Years from now, when you tell your children about this year we've been living through, what scenes will spring to your mind? The chief of communism pounding a table in rage? What sounds will you hear?
In the UN, when Khrushchev took off his shoe and was beating that shoe, and the interpreter said that he was saying, "I'll bury you," talking about America. Khrushchev wasn't saying, "I'll bury you." Khrushchev was saying, "I love you." But it was the interpreter who hated America. You understand what I mean?
But did he have rhythm?
Yeah, he had rhythm, right? Rhythm is my business.
And there you go, the music comes in. There's a lot of music in it, and I wondered, did we get too much music and did it mix in well enough? Did it work overall for you? Because we can't go into the details, Arlene, of everything that's told over here on Mighty Complex.
Here's the problem for me with this. It's overly long and overly complicated for 2.5 hours. I think if this was made into two separate documentaries, each 90 minutes long, I think it would work brilliantly. Mm. There's just so much to cover.
The music separately and the geopolitics.
I'd bring the music into it and then explain what it was to do because it's so, the history is so complicated. When they move from Africa, which is and the Belgian and the king and the Belgium and Leopold and everything like that, that's complicated enough. Mm. But when they come across to the UN, the 15th UN agreement, and that you see, then you know you've got. Malcolm X, you have Che Guevara, you've got
amazing
this unbelievable collection of historical men coming together to fight something that's so, like, you know, anti-colonialism, and it's so powerful, and there's so many people against them, and you've got all these amazing characters like the man from Paris who ends up being a CIA poisoner, and all these incredible.
Maybe
it's a
documentary
cast.
Series.
There should be something. I think it would work brilliantly as a series. I actually genuinely do, because there's so much detail here. I watched this twice and I still don't know everything that went on.
Yeah, I want to get back to it.
You know, I couldn't figure it out, a lot of it out either, but what comes across very strongly is that the Eisenhower administration used jazz as a weapon and sent people like Duke Ellington, Dizzy Gillespie,
Nina Simone,
they sent them as weapons.
Stars from you, John.
Oh, five for me. I was absolutely entranced by this film. Absolutely entranced
and
by
Arlene?
It. Now, I didn't really understand it, a lot of it. I would have to go back
into
it.
See, I gave it 3 out of 5 because I didn't understand a lot of it. Like I said, I did have to watch it twice just to get the detailing that I came here with.
Yeah.
And I think if you did that like over 8 episodes went into
it's a doctoral thesis,
really. That would be amazing.
Yeah. All right. Thanks to John McGuire and Arlene Hunt. Gladiator 2 in general release tomorrow. Joy in selected cinemas this weekend. Netflix from tomorrow week, Friday the 22nd, and Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat in selected cinemas, including the IFI, from tomorrow. Here we go. The End of the World and a Musical may not seem like the most likely bedfellows, but that is exactly what filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer has created in his new film called The End. Joshua is an acclaimed documentary filmmaker. The Act of Killing and The Look of Silence were both set in Indonesia. In this, his first fiction film, he has set the action in a palatial survivalist's bunker 25 years after environmental collapse has left the earth uninhabitable. Mother, father and son, that's what we call them, are played by Tilda Swinton, Michael Shannon and George Mackay. They struggle to maintain hope and a sense of normalcy by clinging to the rituals of daily life. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by director of The End, Joshua Oppenheimer. But first of all, let's listen to a clip in the bunker. This is quite early on, where the doctor, played by Lenny James, comes to admire some decorations in the living room. Mother, Tilda Swinton, father, Michael Shannon, son, George Mackay, and our own Brona Gallagher as friend will be heard at the very end of the clip.
This looks great. To think this all ends with you, only you.
There you are. I was... Forgive me, I'm sorry.
Just
no, don't let me intrude. I just thought that you and I... No, no, you're busy and I'm being rude. Maybe we'll find another time later today.
You want to have breakfast with your dad?
No,
You're swimming with your mom, right?
Yes.
But first, show her what you did with the flowers.
There you go. Brona Gallagher at the very end there. And within that clip as well, you heard George Mackay, Michael Shannon and Tilda Swinton, and I believe Lenny James as the doctor just at the very top of the piece. That is from the film The End. Director Joshua Oppenheimer with me in studio this evening. And I wanted to play that clip fairly quickly at the top to give that sense of how it's a musical where it drifts in and out of spoken word, song texts as well. Why that particular form? What was it about this story that you wanted to tell, Joshua, that meant it had to be a musical?
Well, the musical is really the genre of deluded hope, false hope. You know, there's two types of hope. There's the hope that is really the wolf of despair in the sheep's clothing of hope, which says no matter what happens, everything will be all right. That's the hope of Wile E. Coyote running off the edge of the cliff and thinking he's doing fine until he looks down and then plummets. And I think that's the hope that will lead us to our extinction. And then there's real hope, which is the idea that while it may be too late for the last family in the world, after we've destroyed the climate, destroyed the biosphere, destroyed our societies through indifference and a lack of empathy, there's still hope for you, for me, for the audience to come together and stand up and make change before it's too late. And this whole film is kind of an offering of hope, an offering of possibility, of optimism. And it's a musical because it's a comment on denial, on storytelling, on how we lie to ourselves.
Just to give the setup here, the family are in this bunker. It's absolutely palatial. They clearly were hugely wealthy when the world was in the state that it's in right now. They had the finances to build this place, to get a wonderful art collection brought down there, all of their stuff from their family home, wonderful piano, everything that you could possibly want. You visited such a bunker, I believe, in your research for this.
That's right. I was actually making a documentary about an oil tycoon who had enriched himself by sponsoring political violence so that he could secure his oil concessions. And he was shopping for a bunker like this for his family. And in that bunker, I desperately wanted to ask, how would you cope with the guilt for the catastrophe from which you're fleeing? How would you cope?
Caused by oil, among other things.
By catastrophic climate change. How would you cope with the remorse of leaving your loved ones behind? How would you tell your story to new future generations you might have in the bunker as a way of consoling yourself, as a way of convincing yourself that you lived a better life than you did? And I couldn't ask those questions. And suddenly it came to me that I'll make a musical set in such a bunker. The family will be American because it's a quintessentially American genre and maybe a quintessentially American form of deluded optimism. And it will be called The End.
And they're in this bunker, which has this beautifully, as I say, it's a beautiful house. If you didn't know it was in under a salt mine, you'd quite like to live there. You then put the bunker into a salt mine. That was a real salt mine that you spent time in to do that.
Yeah, that's right. So the interiors are all shot here in Ireland.
Yeah.
And then the exteriors, if you like, are shot hundreds of meters under Sicily and under East Germany in two salt mines, primarily under Sicily. And then exactly we shot for months underground, or for weeks underground.
What was that experience? Because, you know, there is no sense of claustrophobia in the house itself. But when they're in the salt mine, you realise, gee, they are underground. They don't see daylight.
No, yeah. And the son in the family is born underground.
The George Mackay character.
George Mackay's character was born in the sun and born in the mine and has never seen the sky. So he's never been up above. It was a beautiful experience because this salt mine is vast and absolutely pure. So it was a kind of luminous experience of nature, even if it was apocalyptic at the same time, because it was this industrial former, it was actually still a working mine. So they had to stop production in the area where we were shooting. But I felt a great sense of peace. I don't think Brona loved being in the mine, but some of the cast, Moses Ingram, initially hated it and then fell in love with being there. But it was an almost spiritual experience down there.
And you mentioned Moses Ingram. Moses Ingram is the kind of classic film, really, isn't it? A stranger comes to town, a stranger comes to the salt mine and into the bunker. What did that allow you to? Because she brings a very, you know, as we heard in that opening clip, there's a kind of a deluded, they're a bit too happy about their situation. You get that sense quite early on in the film. She brings a whole new energy and a whole new honesty into the house.
Yeah, exactly. She brings the truth. I mean, they remain in the bunker not because they couldn't go up above and see the devastated earth. The bunker's really a prison of shame. And were they to go out, they'd be confronted by what they did to the world and by where they left their loved ones to perish. So they stay there, and in comes someone who has witnessed all of it. And she brings a gift, really, to this family, which is the gift of honesty, the gift of being able to acknowledge her own remorse, her own survivor's guilt, without shame. You see, the difference between guilt and shame, we often don't notice it in English, but but guilt, of course, is the ability, is a feeling of remorse, a compunction, whereas shame is a concern with how you appear in the eyes of others. And she brings that gift to this family, and the whole drama is, will they be able to accept it?
You mentioned that the interiors were shot here in Ireland. You spent 4 weeks rehearsing in Ardmore, in fact, before you did any shooting at all. But I do want to talk about the singing a little bit further, because you said this to me as we were coming to air. The singing happens live on set, and you can hear why it has to, because it kind of weaves in and out of spoken word. It's not quite recitative, but it's not that far off it.
I think the songs that Joshua Schmidt wrote are luminously beautiful, but unlike the kind of cliche about musicals, which they sing their deepest truth, these are luminously beautiful, melodic, harmonious lies. They sing their lies. They sing to cling to their delusions. And where the truth screams through in this film is in the silences, as those stories they're telling themselves unravel, which means the songs, and that's what gets them singing too. So the songs are these kind of breakdowns. As their lies break down, they reach for more lies, and that requires being live with them.
And as you say, you know, they're deluded, but there's a sadness in the fact that they're singing their lies in such beautiful melodies. That was one of the things that came across to me.
I think it's sad and it's universal. I mean, the characters in the end are nameless because they're all of us. It's the whole human family, and it's also each and every one of our families.
The shift from documentary maker to this is a serious feature film. I mean, there's a documentary aspect to it in that you're talking about post-apocalyptic situation. How difficult was it, and how or did it just feel, I'm just making another film?
Methodologically, it's completely different. It's like it was like taking on a second career in a way. But one thing is the same, which is that I'm always looking for those moments that I instantly recognize as true because they're not what I expect, which means I'm inviting the cast to bring me gifts, surprises. And that's exactly what you do when you make a documentary as well.
All right. Well, listen, Joshua, thank you so much for speaking to us about your film, The End. It will be screened at the Cork International Film Festival at the Everyman Theatre on this Saturday. That's the 16th of November. The festival itself continues through until Sunday the 17th, and the film will be released in Irish cinemas, and lovely to see it up on the big screen, I would suggest, and that will be in early 2025. Thanks for being with us, Joshua.
Thank you so much.
Now, if you step into my shoes, I will step into yours. The goal of the NGO Narrative 4 is to achieve a sense of fearless hope through radical empathy. It was set up in 2013 by Irish author Colm McCann and American co-founder Lisa Consilio. The global organisation uses personal storytelling to build empathy between young people from different backgrounds so they can improve their communities and the world together. Participants from different backgrounds exchange stories to build understanding and empathy. Musician Colm McAnamara has been part of Narrative 4 for 10 years at this point, and he joins me now. I think we spoke about Narrative 4 before, but for those who don't know about it, Colm, just give us the sense of what it can achieve through story, and of course you're here doing it through music as well.
Well, I suppose it's an antidote for the times we live in a time where people are disconnected, isolated, and so Narrative 4 focuses on schools and educators and getting young people together and getting them to, giving them the opportunity to share their stories, and in so doing, reconnecting them to each other and to themselves ultimately.
And you have had this experience in different places. I know you've been to Palestine with this project. You've also been to South Africa with it. Give me a specific example of one of those, something from either of those trips that really showed you how people who on the surface of things are miles apart are in fact a lot closer than we all might think.
An abiding memory is, I remember at a conference in New Orleans a couple of years ago, a man a little bit older than myself was doing a story exchange with a young teenager from Soweto, and the older gentleman was, you know, from Middle America, probably red state, and just to see the power of this white man telling this young 13-year-old kid from Soweto's story and inhabiting that, and just how emotional he was, and it's incredibly powerful. Yeah.
And where does the music come into, or how did, because Colm McCann would have started this specifically as Narrative 4, as it suggests, stories. Where did the music start to seep in, and what do you think that has brought?
Well, I think music is a kind of, it's been a part of it all the way through. Sting was an early sponsor and advocate of Narrative 4. And more it's become apparent that music just, as we know, kind of breaks down barriers, it connects. To play music is to listen intently. To play music together is to connect on a metaphysical level, which requires deep listening and response. And so in a way, the music aspect of it is kind of like it's the open fire that people gather in around, you know.
You're going to play something for us.
Yes.
what have you got on your fiddle in front of me?
I thought that I'd play you a reasonably new piece. Well, I haven't played it live hardly at all. And it's a piece. I was musically thunderstruck when I went to Israel and Palestine in 2019 with Colm McCann, and we were visiting refugee camps and schools. And after a particular visit in Nablus, there's an organization, Tomorrow's Youth. I was asked to learn a Dabka rhythm, and that kind of began this very unexpected.
And what the Dabka rhythm would come from, which tradition? There?
It's a Palestinian rhythm. And it occurs to me now that I'm not sure if the Dabka rhythm is included in this piece I'm about to play. However, it began this kind of most of the time, I was explaining earlier, we're talking about this, where writing music is like fish cakes. You take a little bit of here and a little bit there, and you mash it together into something that's palatable. And other times, like the fish leaps out of the water into the boat. And so this was one of those instances. Yeah, so yeah. Let's see how this goes.
Let's see this.
Okay.
Yes, and that was just Colin McInerney, it has to be said, with a series of loops and pedals that you managed to get your feet and head around. Because I know there's particularly heavy traffic this evening and you were caught up on the way in.
Yeah, thankfully I was only caught up in the traffic as opposed to being the reason for it.
Yeah, well, that's good. And thanks for making the effort to get into us. However, I do want you to talk a little bit about the upcoming Christmas benefit, the narrative for you. Yourself and Colm are going to be there in the night. Have we stories and music? What's that evening going to be in the Unitarian Church,
yes,
Colm?
Yes, I suppose we've been doing these events in a few different countries together over these few years, and it's a meeting of literature and music. I mean, I suppose over the past 10 years or so, I found myself in a company of writers and poets more and more. And the music becomes a good kind of vehicle you know, things go deeper when there's music involved, I think.
Yeah, and it is that thing, I suppose, when the words are removed from something, a communication can happen that you don't have to explain to each other.
Yeah, just, absolutely.
It's there.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's been a lovely thing, and I suppose there'll be some special guests as well.
Mm. Yeah. The other thing I wanted to ask you about the narrative for the particular situation in Palestine at the moment. We're in too volatile, too raw situation, I'm presuming, for anything to, like, narrative four to happen.
Yeah, I mean, there has been an ongoing kind of dialogue between some groups in the West Bank, between both communities. But at the moment, obviously, that has stopped since October 7th. And in general, I think the narrative four approach is far more oblique or lateral rather than direct.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not a case of like, let's get these two opposing sides together. And the idea is far more to let people have their own epiphanies and have their own realizations. And so you can have kids from Moy Ross doing story exchanges with kids from, you know, the Bronx, or, you know, we've had some Cherokee Indians from Kentucky who've done story exchanges with people, kids from Belfast and Soweto. So and I suppose the thing that we learn is the unity of humanity, you know.
Yeah, as I said, I think at the beginning, we're all a lot more alike than we are different.
This is it. Yeah, indeed.
A well-known, oft-repeated fact. Colm, thanks so much for coming in to us this evening.
Pleasure, sir.
Colm McNamara speaking to us there about Narrative 4, that Christmas benefit, an evening of stories and music with Colm McNamara, as well as some very special guests. It takes place on Wednesday, the 11th of December at the Dublin Unitarian Church. Information at narrative4.ie, and you can also, if you want to get your school involved in narrative4.ie, you'll find out details about how to do that too. Tickets for the event available from Eventbrite, and I'm not going to be able to find my piece of paper with everybody's names on it. Let's hope for the best. Paula Shields was our Leah Murphy, I think, was the researcher, in fact, this evening. Harry Bookless was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator, and tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. I will talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, once again here on RT Radio 1, and John Creedon will be with you after the news.